Hey everybody, I'm Roxanne. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you, Stephen, for inviting me, and thanks, Jim, for recommending me. Jim was here in Lawrenceville for a while, and he was a good friend, and we miss his face around here. And I guess, you know, every time I'm supposed to talk, I always get nervous. I'm sitting in my own house here. I'm still getting nervous to talk. So that'll tell you something right there. I always think about different things that I want to talk about, and I always got to bring it back to simple and, you know, go back to, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And, I guess people nowadays, I've been sober for a little while. I'm not from the generation, but, my sobriety date is April 3rd, 1978. I have a sponsor. I use a sponsor. And, there are a lot of times I didn't use a sponsor, but I do use a sponsor now. And I have a home group. And I think that, you know, I moved here. I'm originally from California. I went to Colorado, didn't transition well. And I landed in Atlanta, Lawrenceville, and found this wonderful home group. And I'm so, so grateful because this home group here in Lawrenceville has literally saved my ass over the years that I've been here. Wonderful, wonderful people. So I'm very grateful for my home group. So anyway, like I said, I wasn't born there, but I grew up in Southern California in the San Fernando Valley, Los Angeles area. And my father was an alcoholic, and my mother was very angry. And there were six of us. And, you know, people sometimes say, oh, you know, big family, how wonderful. You know, not so wonderful. There was no love. There was no support. There was no, you know, whatever people imagine happens in a big family. There wasn't any of that. My father, he was a drinker. He was, sent out of town a lot. So he was gone a lot. When he was home, there were, you know, staying out all night or coming home late drunk, and the fights and the yelling and the screaming. And, you know, that's where I grew up. My earliest memory, one of my earliest memories was I was like 5 or 6 years old, and I was riding my bicycle, and I was so angry, and I just wanted out. At 5 years old, I knew fear and I knew anger, and that's what I knew. And so that's where I lived. That's, you know, I knew I was different. I didn't know how different I was, but I never felt like I was, one of the many, you know, or whatever that is. So I had my first drink when I was 13, and a gal Murph did down the street, and she was a little older than me, and she said, you know, why don't we get some wine and go get drunk? And so the way we got it was we stood in front of the liquor store and we asked somebody going in to get us a bottle, you know? And so my first drink was, a bottle of Strawberry Hill in the alley. So that's where I started wino in the alley. When I took my first drink, the biggest thing that I remember was the feeling in that the alcohol was magic. It didn't matter who I was, where I was from, you know, what was happening in my home. None of it mattered. I was okay. And, you know, I felt okay for the first time in my life. And, I didn't care what you thought of me. And it was, you know, we went over to the high school dance and we had a great time. And then, you know, at the end of the night, you know, it wasn't so great, but, you know, I figured that was part of the deal. And, I don't think I swore off. I think that I couldn't wait until I could get some more. And, I believe it was my second drunk was the next weekend. It was a bottle of champagne and I started blacking out. So those came very early for me. There's a lot of pieces missing in my drinking. But I wanted, when I drank, I wanted the oblivion. I didn't want to feel. I wanted to escape, and that's what I used it for. I had my first arrest when I was 14, and that was for possession of alcohol. Possession of alcohol. And, basically a slap on the wrist for that. I was 14 and there was a group of us and we were in a car driving and, whatever. We got stopped by the cops and then my second arrest, I was, 15 and I was arrested for public drunk. I was, me and my friend, I was a passenger. We tried to outrun the cops and, she got the drunk driving and, then I was just a public drunk, I guess. And they started sending me to, they sent me when I was 15 to something called the Teenage Alcoholism Program. And I had to go to, I don't know how many meetings, and they tell us, how bad it was to drink and show you the movies and all of that. And we had, speakers come in and tell us, one guy came and told it he was an AA. He was like 19 years old. And, I looked for answers in a bottle and I looked for answers in boys and he was a cute boy. So I went after him a little bit and, he took me to, some AA meetings and, I thought it was a really great place, where my father was an alcoholic. I said, look at these alcoholics. They're happy. They're laughing, this is wonderful for him. I had no even notion that I was an alcoholic. I drank, but there were good reasons for my drinking. if you had the parents I had or, the problems I'd have, you'd drink too, So anyway, that didn't last very long because he gave me some spiel about I was still out there and he was sober and I didn't know what he was talking. I didn't know where out there was. And, that didn't last long and I went on my way. Then I got arrested again I got a car when I was 16 and it was a 1966 Rambler with no reverse. And, I paid $75 for it, but. And, it drove forward and I could sit in the car instead of sitting in the alley because I'm still young. I can't, go to the bars or anything like that. When I started, I once in a while I could get an idea and get into a bar and drink some, but mostly I was drinking, in the alleys alone or with others. It really didn't matter. My goal was to drink. I love my booze. And, so that's what I did. So when I got the car, I drank in the car and I drove the car. And so I got a drunk driving arrest when I was 16. And then it started to get a little more serious. And, I was going to court and, I still didn't know that I was an alcoholic. And I remember, I think it was that arrest when I was sitting in the juvenile court and, The judge looked at me and said, that what disturbed the court was why this 16-year-old is drinking in the first place. And my honest to God answer was, I don't know. And I didn't know why I had to drink. I knew still that there was something wrong with me. Now, when I was drunk, it didn't matter, but I did know there was something wrong with me. And I remember laying in bed and praying to a God I didn't know, who or what he was, or if he was even there, what's wrong with me? I don't know what to do. And so when I got arrested the first time, I called the guy from AA and I said, what do you think I ought to do? And he said, well, I think you ought to go to some meetings and, that was the second one. Sorry. I went to some meetings. I went to one meeting. It was a men's recovery house. It was an open meeting, but it was a men's recovery house. I was 16 and there were nothing but men in the meeting. And, I didn't feel like I fit in. So, I left the meeting and they all told me to keep coming back, and then I went to another meeting and, a couple of couple of older women grabbed a hold of me and set me in between them. And, you know, I couldn't leave then. I had to stay in the meeting because, you know, I had one of them on either side of me, and I didn't get, I was always fearful. So I was, you know, afraid of, you know, of leaving when these women had just set me down there with them. And after the meeting, there was a one-eyed Mexican biker, and he asked if I wanted to go out to coffee with all of them. And, you know, I wasn't drunk then, so I had to say, no, I got to get up in the morning. I didn't realize that AA is full of, all kinds of people. And I've got very, very good friends with, you know, not only that one-eyed Mexican biker guy, but a lot of other friends, you know, that, come from all the sort of places that we come from. And they're the most wonderful people that I know. So anyhow, after that, I decided that I was just going to, I think first I said, maybe I'm not going to drink, and then I'm not going to drink as much, and then I'm not going to drink and drive. But 5 months later, there I was again. I was 17. I was getting arrested for the second time. I had been in a blackout. I don't know even what I was doing. I have vague memories of the night. But here I was again, and I'd been arrested again. And the 16, they'd put me on probation. And basically the idea was that, you know, if I kept doing this sort of thing, I was probably going to go to juvenile hall or something. I don't know if they really would have done that. But I thought they probably were going to. So, I went, first I made a couple of calls, and I asked, you know, to the couple of AA people that I had met, and they told me that, you know, maybe I should go to some meetings and bring a paper, have the secretary sign it. And then when I went to court, you know, I could show them that I was, you know, going to AA meetings and I might not be in so much trouble. So I made those calls, those couple of calls. And then I made a call to my drinking buddy, and I told her that we had to leave town because I had to disappear until I was 18. Because I thought that that would make it okay. If they couldn't catch me till I was 18, then it wasn't good, you know, they wouldn't have anything on me because, you know, minor adult or whatever. But I know that's ridiculous. So we went out to Hollywood one last time before we're going to take off in the mountains. And I had done a lot of not very smart things. One of the things that I like to do was go out to Hollywood with my car with no reverse. And I get stuck up in the Hollywood Hills and, you know, wander around down here. There was a guy killing women walking around in Hollywood at the time. But, you know, none of that mattered to me. I was like fearless. I didn't care. You know, I could put a look on my face and people would leave me alone. And, you know, it was just that cold, hard stare or whatever. But it was my protection. And I brought that into AA with me too. But anyhow, I ended up that night drunk, of course, and, met somebody, of course, and I ended up driving, from Hollywood to Pomona, and I really don't even know how far away Pomona is now. I think it was like an hour and a half or something. It was quite a ways. Anyway, I ended up driving out there and then driving back in the morning. It was a Sunday morning, and I kept nodding off on the freeway, and I remember thinking, and the only thing that woke me up was when I would hit the bumps, you know, the reflective, whatever they are. And I would hit those and wake up. And, I remember thinking I'm going to die. And it was the first time that I really thought that I really considered the fact that I was going to die and then I had to do something. And that was the last night I drank, and I have my sobriety date as April 3rd, but I'm fuzzy on the actual date because when I got arrested, I think it was April 1st, but, I ended up getting my arrest record when I was going to try to be a deputy sheriff, and I pulled my arrest records, and I think it was arrested on April 1st, but anyway, I couldn't quite pinpoint it, so I decided on April 3rd. And that was my last drink. well, my first day of sobriety that Sunday. And I went to work that day because I was a good alcoholic. I needed my booze money. And so I had gone to work. And I went to an AA meeting. And I, like I said, I was very fearful. And the way I dealt with my fear was that I put on the hard face. And I didn't really believe I was an alcoholic, but I knew that if I drank, I got arrested, and I didn't want to get arrested between getting arrested and court time. And so I went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting for, you know, well, it wasn't my first meeting, but first meeting, I haven't had a drink since that meeting. But I went in, and I went in with an attitude, and I went in basically and sat in the back with my arms crossed, and really the look was, you know, I dare you to talk to me. You know, it was just, I was so afraid. And the women did not talk to me. The women went all the way around the room to avoid me because they were afraid, you know, and some of the guys would talk to me, but mostly they just told me to keep coming back. You know, mostly because they understood, you know, some of them, I understand the people when they come in and they have the hard look and the toughness. I understand they're scared. Some people don't understand. If you haven't lived it, you don't understand it, you know, if you haven't seen it or whatever. Some understood that and they just told me to keep coming back. And I did. And I went to, when I started off, I went to, at least two meetings a day. We had a lot of meetings, two meetings, three meetings, four meetings a day. I was 17 and, I was in high school, and that's what I did. I went to the meetings and I didn't drink. And like I said, I didn't really know. I hadn't accepted to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. But I didn't want to drink, and I went to a lot of meetings. And when I was in the meetings, I, you know, all you got to say is you're an alcoholic and you can talk. And apparently, whereas I guess when I was drunk, I talked a lot, but when I wasn't drinking, when I was sober, I had nothing to say. I was shyish and all of that. But for some reason, coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a lot to say and I said it. And a lot of it wasn't very nice. I had a lot of anger in me. And it started spewing in meetings, and I would talk in the meeting, and I'd tell them, you know, that they were full of it, or, you know, any number of things that I would say, you know. But when I did that in the meetings, that meant anybody else could come right back at me. You know, I think crosstalk and, you know, the more gentle AA came along a little bit later, but in 1978, they weren't real nice. You know, they weren't nice and gentle for the most part. You know, they were, you know, meetings turning over tables and stomping out. And, you know, one of the places I went to meetings, the Allen S Club, you know, a couple times seeing people get thrown down the stairs. I mean, it was kind of rough. But, you know, I would talk and they would talk back. I had to leave meetings a couple of times because they would talk and I couldn't talk again, so I left. but anyway, my first year of sobriety was done a lot of self-will run riot. People would always ask me, do you have a sponsor? And I got tired of saying no, so I would ask this woman or that woman to be my sponsor and never call them. But when they asked, I could say, yeah, I got a sponsor, you know. But I was, you know, like I said, self-will run riot and, not quite convinced that I was an alcoholic. When I finally went to court on my, drunk driving and while we were waiting, we got postponed a few times and my father would go with me and, round about noontime when we went to have lunch, I would watch him shake because he needed a drink. And I decided that I needed to get my father sober after I got through my court case and I stayed in AA and I thought that, you know, it would be a good place for my dad. And I would, you know, point out the AA meetings to him. And, you know, he was an alcoholic that never found AA. He told me that the alcohol, the beer, that was the only way he knew how to live, and that was his truth. And so I think that, that's why if we make it to these doors, how fortunate we are, because some people, they never get it. They never even get to walk in, and he did not. And when I was a year sober, I was getting ready to celebrate my first year sober. And back there in LA, we do the whole, the birthday cake meetings, and everybody comes and happy birthday. It's a big, big party at every meeting it can be. But, I was going to have my dad come and give me my cake. And that was how I was going to get him into an AA meeting. And, unfortunately, 5 days before that birthday, he had an aneurysm bust in his head, and he landed in the hospital for a few days before he died. And I walked through that, and what I came out with, it was like, this was the only love that I felt in my family, was that he would get drunk sometimes and tell me that he loved me, And so this is a guy that loved me. And it was, I walked through it. I didn't drink. And when I came out the other side, I was convinced that I was an alcoholic, because and I don't even know how I got the idea or who I talked to, but he had an aneurysm that broke. And I guess somebody had said that that can be caused by alcohol over a number of years or whatever. And, I bought that, and that was my convincer that I was an alcoholic, because watching him, I could see my future. Now, interestingly enough, when I was, I guess it's in 2008, so however many years that is, and I've been sober for a while, they found a bunch of those things in my head. And, I hadn't been drinking for a long time, so apparently it was genetic and not alcoholism. But they were able to fix mine, which was a really good thing, because otherwise I probably wouldn't be here. But anyhow, it was after that happened that I became convinced that I was an alcoholic, and that I had to do the work involved to stay here. I became willing to do it your way, and not tell you were wrong, and not, I was very into my different. I was 17 in 1978. There were not very many young people. There were a few, but not many. Meetings were, I saw the differences. I saw the older people that had, had families and kids and, careers. And I didn't have any of that stuff. When I got sober, I hadn't lost all the things that y'all had lost. What I had lost was anything I ever was, and I don't even know if I guess when I was born, I probably was all the stuff, but through the childhood and the home and the fear and the anger, I don't know what was inside. That's all I had was fear and anger. But I started to learn, they said that they loved me in AA, and I started to believe that. And I started, working steps. I got a sponsor and did start working steps. So my first sponsor, though, was like a, I picked the lady that no one ever expected me to pick, just for, to shock everybody. But I did use her, and I did start working steps, and I started taking on some service commitments. When I was a couple of years sober, 2 or 3 years sober, I was still trying to manage my life. And I had the car was falling apart, the job was no good, and I couldn't make ends meet. I was out on my own. I was, I think I was like 21 years old, and I felt like I got to a breaking point. They talk about, standing on the ledge, and taking that leap. And first the leap was, I just wanted out. I was in so much pain and feeling so much fear and so much hopelessness. And I've been sober for a few years, so You know, I don't know if it's because I did it the hard way or the wrong way. I didn't do the wrong way because I didn't drink, but a lot of my sobriety in those years was, you know, really trying to figure it out on my own and not, you know, I talked to a sponsor, you know, kind of sort of used a sponsor, but really I was trying to figure it out on my own. And, so the first jumping off, I felt like I wanted to check out, you know. And I spent, I think, like, you know, several hours, you know, crying and screaming and calling people saying, you know, I'm losing it. I want out. And I ended up after that on my knees and truly giving it over to God. I'd done a third step, you know, I'd done a couple of third steps, but it was the first time that I really felt like I gave it all up to God. You know, I couldn't manage the car and the job and the, you know, relationships or whatever else was going on. I gave him the booze, but I hadn't given him all the other stuff. And once I did that, you know, and, you know, you take it back a little bit, but once I understood the concept that I could not continue trying to do it my way or trying to figure it out. And after that, it got a little bit easier when times went hard to go to God. It still took a while. Over the years, it's like the period of time before I give it up to God got shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter, you know, but it's through a lot of, giving it up, seeing what God does with it, you know, and saying, oh, well, I should have done that sooner, you know, and God has proven time and time and time again, coming up with way better ideas than I ever had, you know. You know, and I've taken, you know, I've taken a lot of four steps in a lot of ways. Every time I take a four step, I find out new things about me and, the way I look at the world. And for me, fear is the driving force for all of my defects of character, for, you know, the resentments, you know, I had so many resentments when I got here. I was so angry all the time for a lot of years, just like that low simmering boil, angry, you know, just anything. And I was just popping off, you know, and it took a lot of time through the steps and I'm burying all those fears. You know, what am I afraid of? Why do I have to have this, you know, this wall up for the whole world, you know? And little by little it breaks down, but you know, it took years and years for that stuff to come down for me. You know, and I did end up getting married to a fellow alcoholic, you know, boy meets girl on AA campus. And, you know, we were married and we had a baby and, you know, all of that stuff. And it wasn't, it turned out not to be all that healthy. And, I got Shanghai from LA to Colorado, in 1997. And at that point I was living in a lot of fear, again with the fear, because I was afraid to change what was wrong. And, what was wrong was my situation, and it was getting harder and harder to live in it. And so I had to make a decision when I was in Colorado. And I don't know if anybody else has ever heard of it, but there was a meeting called Golden Slippers, and it started some people in Denver. I think it was, I don't know where it came from, but somebody came up with it at the Denver International. Somebody heard about it. And I kind of think that somebody in Canada had talked about it, but you know, as a group meeting, we went through the big book, and I did this in Colorado. We did it with all women, and you could do it with ever, but reading exactly what's in the book. And whenever we come to an action, the meeting stops and you go home and take the action. The first action is saying the third step prayer. And then when we got read to that point, we all did that. And then when we, you know, read to, you know, taking the inventory, like, okay, the first column, and we'd all go do that. So it was an exact working out of the big book. And, it was absolutely the best set of steps I ever took. It was like the most miraculous thing that ever happened, because when I got to about step three there, I knew that something had to happen, and I had to get, as afraid as I was, I had to make a change and make a choice. And I was really scared. And when the time came, the words came out of my mouth and I didn't know where I literally looked around because I didn't know where they came from because I'm too scared to say those words. And, it was, you know, telling my husband that, you know, I can't be in this anymore. And the worst things that I imagined could happen did happen. I was, him and my daughter left. They tore me up one side and down the other and took off. And I had the house and the responsibilities and I had to sell it and, you know, went through this whole thing. And I hadn't connected to AA in Colorado, cause I was scared. I would walk up to a meeting and I'd been to hundreds, if not thousands of meetings. I'd walk up to a meeting and I'd be too scared to open the door. I'd turn around and go. And it wasn't until that Golden Slippers meeting that I was able to, you know, get back in, you know, and make these things, you know, make these, you know, decisions and, you know, moves in my life. But anyway, it was at that point it got difficult and it was dark. But I knew God was there because he had shown himself to me. So I was able to walk through. And then I landed in Atlanta. I moved here. I, you know, the internet started, you know, and I went to an AA chat room and, you know, I met an alcoholic that lived in Atlanta and, you know, we started, you know, long distance courting and all that, you know. So I moved to Atlanta to marry a man and that's how I landed here. That lasted for a while and I met a lot of great people in Alcoholics Anonymous here. And, you know, I talked about my home group for a minute. You know, I'm so grateful that I landed in this home group because there is so much love and support and sobriety and, you know, all of that. When I moved to Colorado, I didn't really, it was a hard transition. But when I got to Atlanta, when I was in Colorado, one of the things I did do is I did get a service commitment. I became an intergroup rep. And that helped me to, you know, when I was on my own there, it helped me to get involved and get back into Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, to get back into the middle of the bed, like they say. And so when I got to Atlanta and I did, you know, when I found the home group, I knew that I had to get service commitments and I still take those service commitments. I was you know, doing the roster or the secretary of the meeting. And, you know, I didn't go to a lot of meetings since I've been here. When I found my home group, I go to the home group a couple times a week and there were other meetings I went to. I no longer went to 2-3 meetings, even a meeting a day. You know, but the home group was so important for me and finding a sponsor here in News. I did get a sponsor here. And I use that sponsor. It has changed now, but that's okay too. And continuing to work the steps. And now when I got sober, I didn't really do it I don't like to say the right way because I think that the only wrong way to do it is drinking. But I did it the hard way, you know, which is my way. Or without taking suggestions, you know, and today I do it the easy way or the easier, softer way, which is, you know, I go to the home group meeting when I can. I also, when I was, back in 2008, when they found these, you know, aneurysms in my head, the reason they found them was because I got a mystery illness. They didn't know what was wrong with me, but I was, you know, my muscles were getting very weak and I was falling down and I couldn't get up. And it was really scary because they couldn't figure it out. And if the doctors can't figure it out, am I going to keep walking? Am I going to be in a wheelchair? I did not know. And there's people in this room right now that remember that. They saw it, which is really great. But I was really scared and they sent my home group, one of the ladies in my home group, Joanne, she sent an email out and everybody was praying for me. Everybody was praying for me. And you know, because I was sick anyway, the point of this was that they finally gave me an MRI because the doctors couldn't figure it out. I changed doctors. I got a doctor, gave me an MRI, and they found my aneurysms in my head. Had I not gotten, see, and this is perspective. I go a lot on perspective, perception or whatever it is, in my life because I got sick, they finally took a scan of my brain and they found the aneurysms that would have killed me otherwise. So it's a good thing I got sick. Otherwise I'd be dead. And that's, you know, back when I got sober, there was a guy who used to talk about, you know, this happened, and he'd say, oh, that's good. And I said, no, that's bad because this happened. I said, well, that was bad. No, that's not bad because, you know, this happened. And I'm a strong believer on the seemingly bad that's necessary for my growth. Everything I've been through has made me better. My father dying, I was convinced that I was an alcoholic when I was sick. And falling down, I had to ask for help. You know, I mean, I had strangers had to pick me up. You know, I'm falling down wherever I was. And there were things that I could not do. There's still things that I can't do, and I do have to ask for help. so, you know, and in fact, at the Zoom meetings, you know, I one of the things I always think about that how great it is, you know, when I got sober, they would talk about the loners. You know, that had wrote letters back then to communicate with other alcoholics. If anybody remembers that. And now these people that are, you know, living, you know, can't get out, housebound people in the service or whatever, they can jump on a computer and get a meeting. You know, how great is that? It's wonderful. You know, through the pandemic, you know, we got to stay in touch in AA. You know, we got to see each other. We can still, I think that it's really fortunate that we have this kind of thing now. I like to touch on forgiveness because I was so angry. And I was so angry. And as the fear goes away, you get less angry. I was full of a lot of anger and sadness when my marriage ended, when the guy that I moved here to marry, that marriage ended. And I was very sad and very hurt the way it happened. And I got tired of feeling that way. And so I got on my knees and I started praying for him, which is something, you know, I don't know. It's all good and well to pray for, you know, pray for people. They always say that you got to pray for them, got to pray for them. But this was like serious. This was serious hurt and serious anger and everything else. But I couldn't do it anymore. And so I got on my knees and I started praying for him. And after a few days, I threw my other husband in there too. So I had husband one and husband two praying for him every morning. And the most wonderful thing happened is that, you know, I got okay with both of them. You know, the forgiveness came and it was like, you know, it was a whole different perception of, you know, the relationships or whatever. And I could let go, the letting go of the sadness or the hurt or the anger or whatever, and just be okay, you know, just to move on and be okay. It was really a very wonderful thing for me. And so I'm a big advocate, for praying for people that have hurt me or wronged me, you know, the forgiveness. The second husband here, I ended up, you know, after 4 years of being divorced from him, he started, you know, coming around and we started to be friends, which I don't even know if we ever were before that, you know, but we started to be friends and we spent some time together. And I was able to, where I felt he had wronged me, I was able to give to him. He had a stroke. He had a major stroke and he was in a hospital and then a nursing facility for about 18 months. We were unable to move, unable to get out of bed, whole right side, everything. And I was able to go to a man that I felt had hurt me a lot and care for him because of forgiveness. And just to give, and that's one of the greatest things. I now have I now have a group of women that every morning we have a group gratitude text. There's like, I don't know if there's 10 or 11 of us now. It started with two, you know, and we share three things we're grateful for every morning. We send this text, and the text is, it's huge, you know, but it's like every morning you get up and you say good morning and you find three things to be grateful for. And you get to hear about everybody else's, and they're in the group. They're, well, now there's new ones again, but, there were like, I think three that were in their first year through the first year of it, you know, and watching the growth and watching the gratitude come, watching the miracle of AA. It's tremendous. You know, I have a regular life. I didn't think I was ever going to have a regular life, but I get up and I go to work and I do the best with what I got. I'm grateful and thank God every day for my sobriety, for, you know, my job being able to take care of myself. I had like seven jobs my first year of sobriety, you know, I've been at the same job for, you know, almost 21 years now, you know, I was able to buy myself a home 9 years ago, all by myself. You know, I got reliable transportation from a, you know, a rambler with no reverse, you know, I got a good car that gets me everywhere I need to go. And I have all these things and this life because of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there's no other way. And it's like, I look at it sometimes, it's like, I've spent almost my whole life here. You know, I've gone through all this stuff, you know, I've watched my daughter that I had turn into a drug addict and come out the other side of it. I thought she would die. I thought I'd bury her. But God didn't think that was supposed to happen. So she's clean right now and still alive, which I think is a miracle because, you know, I thought she'd be dead a few times and I got grandkids and, you know, all that stuff. It's just a regular life and I never thought I had a chance and I'm not mad anymore. I mean, I get mad, but I'm not like mad all the time, you know, I'm not afraid all the time, you know, and I trust God and every morning I get up and I talk to God and I tell him, you know, thanks for everything and you know, do the readings and, you know, meditation and that kind of thing and try to keep that conscious contact with God going. You know, I know I can't do this by myself. I know I would not have any of this by myself, you know. So from self-will, you know, relying on me, because if you don't rely on yourself, it's nothing's going to happen, you know. To just having a good life, you know, you know, I don't know, just normal, you know, for the most part. Now, because I was sick and my muscles went bad, I walked kind of funny, but, you know, with a cane and that kind of thing. But I try not to take myself too seriously even with that. But, you know, it's you know, life goes up, life goes down, and we just stay sober. I just stay sober and, you know, keep coming back. And so I think that's about all I got to say, and thank you for asking me to do this. And, you know, as always, I'm always glad when it's over. So that's all. Thank you.